It really is with great pleasure that I introduce Annette Karmeloff-Smith, who's had a distinguished career and really continues as a leader in the field of infant development, developmental psychology, as I understand it, being a molecular person, and was, until she retired in 2003, the head of the Neurocognitive Development Unit at the Institute of Child Health in London, where she ran a research team that studied typical and atypical infant and child development. She now occupies a full-time professorial research fellowship at Birkbeck Center for Brain and Cognitive Development. Her CV is amazing. I actually hurt my back carrying the hard copy of her CV over here. She has a doctorat en psychologie génétique et expérimentale from Geneva University, where she studied and worked with Piaget. She's a member of the Academia Europea, a fellow of the British Academy and of the Academy of Medical Sciences. She's the author of 7 books and 200 articles and chapters, as well as many booklets for parents on different aspects of child development. She's given more plenary or keynote lectures than anybody else whose CV I've ever seen. So it's really great that she came here. And she received numerous honors. And I'm going to embarrass her now a little bit. In 2002, she won the European Science Foundation Lattice Prize for the Cognitive Sciences and has honorary doctorates from the Universities of Louvain, Zhejiang, and Amsterdam. In 2004, she was awarded a Commander of the British Empire from the Queen, a distinction that Wikipedia, according to Wikipedia, includes Catherine Zeta-Jones. Last year, she received the British Psychological Society Lifetime Achievement Award. On a personal note, Dr. Karmeloff-Smith would never, is exceptionally modest about all of these achievements. She has 2 daughters and 7 grandchildren and states that one of the most important periods in her life was her work volunteering in a Palestinian refugee camp in Beirut. And so it's with great pleasure that I introduce Dr. Karmeloff-Smith, Understanding Autism from a Cross-Syndrome Developmental Perspective.
First of all, thank you, Dan, for that very nice and embarrassing introduction. I'm sure many of you may be wondering what the hell I'm doing here, because I'm certainly not an autism researcher. And in this audience, there are many people whose work I've admired for years who are real experts in the field, so it's not without humility that I face them today. And actually, when Dan first invited me, I thought he'd made a mistake, but he assured me that he hadn't and that he wanted me to talk about development. So mainly today, I'm going to talk about other neurodevelopmental disorders, and I'm also going to mention domains that aren't usually talked about in autism research, such as number, but we'll come to that a little later. But what I want to do above all is to make a very strong case for a developmental approach, a truly developmental approach, tracing things back to their origins in infancy. And also to make a very strong case, I hope, for the benefits of looking at cross-syndrome comparisons, not only in terms of dissociating them, but actually looking for associations across them. And I think we can draw from that more subtle understanding of each particular syndrome in its own right. Okay, so the plan of my talk is as follows. I'll start with asking the question, is development domain general or domain specific? And I'll offer a third alternative, which I call domain relevant. I'll then go on to talk about 2 approaches, a domain specific and a domain relevant approach to a cross syndrome comparison of Williams syndrome and Down syndrome in the domain of infant number, numerosity sensitivities. I'll go on to talk about the fact that behavioral scores in the normal range often camouflage very different underlying neural and cognitive processes. But above all and throughout, I hope I'll convince you that developmental time matters at absolutely every level of analysis. So first, the domain general approach. Well, Dan mentioned the fact that I had studied with Piaget, and Piaget was perhaps the most famous example of taking a very general approach and arguing that 3 processes, assimilation, accommodation, and equilibration, could explain development in any domain one looked at, be it number, social cognition, physics, space, and so forth. Another similar approach, although of a different nature, came from production systems. David Clarke was a good example of using production systems to compute and look at how problem solving occurred across many, many different domains, using exactly the same production system to explain development across these domains. But the problem with the domain general approach, in my view, is that it has difficulty in accounting for uneven cognitive profiles. And obviously, autism is a very good example of an uneven cognitive profile, as are many other syndromes, and even in normal development. We find children who are very good at maths and poor in language and so forth. So how could a single mechanism, or a single set of mechanisms, that apply across many different domains explain these uneven profiles? So a lot of people then opted for a domain-specific approach. And I think the motivation for this came very much from adult neuropsychology. So in adults whose brains have developed normally but who have an accident or a brain insult later in life, we find cases where one domain, like number, might be impaired with the rest of the system looking relatively normal, as in dyscalculia, or prosopagnosia, where the domain of faces, recognizing faces, is impaired, whereas the rest of the system looks relatively normal. And people jumped on this because they found children with genetic disorders who also seem to have these very pure dissociations, such as in the so-called developmental dyscalculia or developmental prosopagnosia, where you have one area that is impaired and the rest of the system, where the results fall, quotes, in the normal range. But we'll come back to that. The problem for me with the domain-specific approach is that it really ignores the role of development. So, in my view, the adult neuropsychological model simply won't work for developmental disorders. The notion of impaired and intact modules makes a very static view of the brain and doesn't take into account all the interactions across domains as the system develops and becomes specialized over developmental time. So, for me, domain specificity may be the outcome of development. We may indeed have modules, very specialized parts of the brain in the adult, but they are not necessarily the starting point. So not built-in modules, but a process of modularization over developmental time. And the argument I want to make is that initially, very often, we see both hemispheres competing to process inputs. And the circuits that are the most domain-relevant win out and become specialized over developmental time. And I want to illustrate domain relevance as I go on. But what I want to suggest is that we always need to keep in mind the fact that development changes over time. So if it's not built-in domain-specific modules, is the only alternative to go to the domain-general process, which is what Pinker in his book argued, that if you can't have domain specificity, then you have the wrong domain-general approach, which he rightly criticized, but I don't think he saw the alternatives. And the alternative I want to suggest is that we have domain-relevant starting points. These include biological constraints. It's not just one sort of mush of a brain with anything goes. But it takes account of cross-domain interactions over time. And it also, in my view, is a much more developmental view than the domain-specific accounts. And I want to illustrate this from the FOXP2 gene, because I think it's a very nice illustration of how one can think in terms of domain relevance. So as I'm sure many of you know, there's a family in Greater London, the KE family, and people found that in this family there were a number of different generations where they had very serious speech and language impairments. And as time went on, Simon Fisher and collaborators at Oxford found that in those family members where there was an impairment, a gene, the FOXP2 gene on chromosome 7, showed a very small 2 amino acid mutations across all these different generations. And there was a lot of hype that followed this initial discovery. People said it's the gene for language, the gene for intelligence, the dawn of cognitive genetics, etc. But very quickly, it was found that this gene is actually highly conserved across many different species. So work on the bird, for instance, showed that the FOXP2 expression is much greater over developmental time while the chick is learning its song, much greater than when subsequently the adult is singing its song. So the expression of FOXP2 changes over developmental time and seems to play a greater role in plasticity and learning early on when the chick is learning its song. FOXP2 studies in the mouse also looked at developmental expression over time. And here they found that although FOXP2 was widely expressed in the brain initially, over time, it became increasingly expressed in motor circuits, particularly the cerebellum, again suggesting something to do with motor planning. And then when researchers came back to the human case, they found that indeed the FOXP2 impairment in these family members was not confined to speech and language. In fact, there were serious deficits in other motor planning fields. So just in oral facial articulation sequences, as you can see here on the board, making movements without sound across the face in the mouth, they were very impaired compared to controls. They had problems with fine motor control as well, as well as with the production and even perception of simple rhythms and violations of simple 1-1-1-1-1-1-1-2-3. So very, very simple rhythms were very difficult for these family members. So FOXP2 is highly conserved. You find it even in the snake. We've seen it in baby chicks, in the mouse, and in the human. And what they all seem to have in common is that it contributes to the skilled coordination of rapid movement sequences and their timing. And this is importantly different from saying it's a gene for language, for instance. So FOXP2 is not domain specific to language, but it is most domain relevant to human speech, the rapid timing of movement sequences, and thereby to language over developmental time. But if it's not domain-specific and thought of in terms of domain relevance, then it raises very different questions, and I'd like to just suggest a few of them. We don't then just look at oral communication and language. We ask the question about sign language, a medium where rapid coordination of movement sequences and their timing is absolutely critical. And we could then predict that people with this FOXP2 mutation, even though their speech is very, very impaired, would not be able to learn any better sign language once you've moved from oral communication. We might also look at various things like playing the piano, playing the violin, where the rapid coordination of movement sequences and timing is critically important. We might even look at rapid dance movement and so forth. So we would then predict from domain relevance a series of things that might go wrong if you have this mutation, which you wouldn't predict if you were just looking at domain-specific language. But it also raises different questions for animal models. Instead of trying to look at bird song, which was important, or cries in the mouse, one starts to ask what in an animal's repertoire might involve the rapid movement sequences and their timing, and then look at that in animal models. So it raises very many different questions beyond the sort of more obvious question of the language impairment. So I'd now like to go on and show you some data, which I'll interpret from two different points of view, one from a domain-specific point of view and one from a domain-relevant point of view. And the examples I want to give are a comparison of infant sensitivity to number. Under the domain-specific interpretation, I've shown a neat double dissociation between Down syndrome and Williams syndrome, which I'll go on to now. So first we're going to look at small number discrimination in infants and toddlers with Williams syndrome and Down syndrome. The early study done by Sarah Patterson, who I think is here and has gone on to do autism research, which I'm very happy about, looked at very simple familiarization of a child to pairs of objects. I can't point here. Oh, here we go. To pairs of objects that they see, familiarized over time, until the number changes to 3. And we're looking to see whether the baby orients longer to this change in number. Typically, developing infants can do this at about 3 to 4 months. And when we tested Williams and Downs infants at 10 to 39 months, so taking into account differences in mental age, we found that the Williams syndrome infants looked just like the chronologically matched controls, and the Downs syndrome infants didn't even do as well as the mental match controls. And we replicated this more recently with a series of dots changing from 2 to 3 or 3 to 2 so that we could pick up on the typically developing literature. So we have Williams syndrome look like typical controls, Down syndrome look considerably worse. We then went on to look at large number discrimination in Williams syndrome and Down syndrome. And we looked at approximate large number, so magnitude ratios of 1 to 2, where we looked at 8 dots versus 16 dots, a similar design, familiarization to one number and then a change to the other, and looking at how long they looked at it. This time our results were very different. We tested both Williams and Downs. I don't know why I just have Williams there. In this case, the Down syndrome infants looked like the chronologically matched controls, and the Williams syndrome infants at best looked like the mental age match controls. So this time we have a different pattern. Downs looks like typical, Williams look far worse. So anyone with a background in adult neuropsychology would jump on this enthusiastically and say, we have a double dissociation, small exact number versus large approximate number across these two developmental neurodevelopmental disorders. So everything seems very clear. We have this double dissociation, two separable number subsystems. They seem to be innately specified because they're there in infancy. They seem to be genetically determined because we have two very different genetic disorders. In Williams, one or more of the 28 genes that are deleted on chromosome 7 seem to contribute to a domain-specific deficit in approximate numerosity discrimination. And in Downs, one or more of the extra genes on chromosome 21 contribute in the overproduction of the protein to a domain-specific deficit in exact small number discrimination. And I could perhaps pat myself on the back with all this very clear data. But of course, it's not that clear. First of all, these cross-syndrome differences are relative. They're not absolute. They don't do nothing in the other domain. They're worse in the other domain, but this is a relative judgment. Second, I believe it's crucial to trace the number deficits back to their origins in much more basic level, domain-relevant processes, and that's what I want to show you now. So one of the questions we asked was, how do the infants scan the numerical arrays that they're presented with? And our hypothesis was that if you scan a large array well, your brain is focusing on global quantity. Whereas if you scan a small array, your brain is focusing on individual objects. And that's what we looked at by looking at eye tracking in these two populations. Well, this is a typical Down syndrome infant with 8 dots. And as you can see very clearly, if I can find this thing, the child is looking at all of the dots going back and forth between them. Now look at the same 8 dots and a Williams syndrome infant. The child is very focused on a few of the dots and not looking at the others at all. And we see exactly the same pattern in 16 dots. In the Down syndrome case, they don't look at all of the dots, but they're quite clearly looking at a number of different dots and the whole array. Whereas in Williams, again, we see this very focused scanning pattern. But this is a top-down process. The brain has to see this array and then make decisions about where to look. So what if we make it even simpler and look at a bottom-up process? And this was a study done many years ago by Janice Brown, a PhD student, with Sarah Patterson and others, looking at the planning of eye movements when there's a stimulus that makes the eyes move. So I'm just going to show you very quickly how this works. The baby is focused on a very interesting stimulus on the screen. While they're still fixated on that, target one comes up and disappears, target two comes up and disappears in left and right peripheral vision. I'll just show you that again so it's clear. And what we found was very, very clear. The Down syndrome infants looked very much like the typically developing infants. They were just slightly slower. So they used what we call body-centered processing. They looked at the stimulus. They moved their eyes to where the blue light had flashed, but it had gone by then. They then updated the image on the retina and then moved to where the yellow light had flashed. This was typical then of the controls and the Down syndrome infants. The Williams infants, by contrast, made lots of different errors. They either stayed fixated here and didn't move their eyes at all, or a few of them made one eye movement but no more. But many of them made what is called the retinocentric error. They moved their eyes to where the blue light had been, but they failed to update the image on the retina and then moved to the wrong place on the screen. Sorry, I can't find this. Oh, here it is. I wish I could point. I'm not allowed to, I was told. Or they made another error, the vector summation error, where they planned the two eye movements from this point, summated them, and arrived in the wrong place here in the middle. So the Williams infants were extremely impaired in something very basic that a Down syndrome infant can solve easily. So a very basic level deficit in visual saccade planning early in the trajectory of Williams syndrome can lead to deficits in numerical magnitude processing. But what I wanted to ask was, could this deficit impact on any other domains, since there's a lot of interaction across the brain early on and only specialization as development proceeds? One of the things in the literature had been the very big difference, certainly in older children and adults with Williams syndrome, between number and face processing. So people with Williams syndrome were considered to be almost intact in their proficient face processing, part of the ventral stream, whereas number was seriously impaired in the dorsal stream. So the question I asked was, could visual saccade planning deficit be domain relevant, not only to explain deficits, but also could explain proficient behaviors? And this is what we looked at. So many different labs have shown that people with Williams syndrome are very good at face processing on standardized tasks like the Bentham, the Rivermead, and so forth. Their scores fall in the normal range. But what about the WS brain? Well, again, a student, Sarah Grice, had a look at this using high-density ERP net and looked at the difference between processing of human faces, monkey faces, and cars. So what we showed was that despite the very good behavioral scores in face processing of Williams syndrome, there was not, in fact, progressive modularization. So if you look at the controls here, you see a very clear N170, so 170 milliseconds roughly after the brain sees the face, there's a negative dip at N170. And this is true for human and monkey faces, but not for cars. There's a different brain signature when healthy controls see a car. This was not the case, however, for Williams syndrome. In this case, both human faces, monkey faces, and cars showed the same atypical brain signature. And the same was true when we looked at sculpt maps and inverted and upright faces. In the healthy controls, you see stronger right lateralization for upright faces and bilateral processing. I really can't use this thing for inverted faces, and a really strong statistical difference between the two, whereas in Williams syndrome, there was no difference between upright and inverted faces in terms of brain localization. So despite very good behavioral scores, Williams syndrome failed to specialize over time and also failed to localize. And it seems that what they're doing is a much more featural analysis of faces. And somehow this is allowing them to get their normal scores on the Bentham and the Rivermead, but not when this is pushed in other types of study. I just want to do a little aside here on an important distinction between the developed brain and the developing brain, also from the example of Williams syndrome. So the fusiform face area in Williams syndrome brains, in adults that is unusually large in proportion to the other regions. The overall brain is smaller. And there are two interpretations one might take of this. which can only be answered, in my view, by taking a developmental approach. The first is that it's the large FFA that causes this unusual proficiency with face processing in Williams syndrome. So we go from brain to behavior. But another interpretation is that the unusual focus on faces that you see in Williams syndrome throughout very early childhood influences the enlargement of the FFA over developmental time. So in this case, we have an interaction between brain and behavior, and not just a causal thing from brain to behavior. And I think keeping this interaction in mind in many of our interpretations of what goes on when we look at brain-behavior relations is extremely important. I'll just make another speculative thing that may make you laugh, but I think it's worth thinking about. Even if it's wrong, I think it's kind of the right way to think about these things. So let's try and ask, why are they so fascinated with faces? Well, we know they have heightened auditory processing, and we know from typical development that the last 3 months in utero, the baby spends a lot of time doing auditory processing. So let's imagine that the heightened auditory processing, with a lot more sluggishness elsewhere, means that when the baby is born, there's an immediate focus on mother's speech. We know they can recognize mother's speech in utero and ex utero. This, of course, is contingent with her face. She speaks and you turn to the source of the sound, and that's her face. The infants with Williams syndrome have this problem in disengaging visually, and that could lead to the fascination with faces. Maybe wrong, but I think this is the kind of exercise we need to do, always going back and trying to see what has led to the final result, because none of us understand this high fascination with faces that you see in very young babies with Williams syndrome. Okay, so back to our face processing examples. We had scores in the normal range, but they were underpinned by different neural processes, different cognitive processes, much more featural than in the typical case. And we can argue that the mutated genes in this case actually influence the proficient domain and not just the impaired, the very obviously impaired domains. We then went on to look at face processing in infants with Williams syndrome and Down syndrome. And here we habituated the child, familiarized the child to a typically structured face. We then either changed a feature, the eyes, or we changed the configuration. And to cut a very long story short, typically developing infants are sensitive to both. They notice and orient to changes in features and changes in configuration. Whereas Williams syndrome infants were much more sensitive to the local featural details, and Down syndrome infants were more sensitive to the global changes. So what I'm arguing is that basic level deficits in visual saccade planning very early in this trajectory lead to sticky fixation, a focus on local features, featural processing of faces, and in all these cases it's different in Down syndrome, and that this leads to the poor large approximate number discrimination because they don't scan well, but a good small exact number discrimination because they focus very locally. So there are cascading developmental effects across several emerging higher level domains, which will become much more independent as development proceeds in the normal case, but that these are actually affecting from a much lower level what the outcome will be. And there are implications of this for intervention. If you have a domain-specific approach, your intervention is usually targeted at that domain. But if you have a domain-relevant approach, your intervention thinking will change. So first, it seems to me that we've shown that intervention should be syndrome-specific. We should know exactly what the roots of something are for a particular syndrome. It should start really early in infancy. And in the case of Williams syndrome, for instance, it should start before the number and face processing strategies emerge. And it shouldn't necessarily be in the domain of deficit. So don't train number, even though you know number is impaired, but train, say, saccadic eye movements, with the hope that that will impact over developmental time on these other domains. In Down syndrome, it would be different. They're good at scanning, but they're not good at sustaining attention. So that's what we might train, attention in Down syndrome, rather than small number discrimination. We're trying to get them we're trying to capitalize on what we understand of the roots of something and then train that with the hope that it will have long-term downstream effects. So in the case of Williams syndrome, we're hoping that that would have an effect on number, on face processing, but also on other domains that are very relevant to problems in autism. So triadic interaction, for instance, when the parent points, establishes mutual gaze, points to an object, names it, etc. If you can't plan rapid eye movements between mother and child and the object, you're going to miss out on a lot of naming. And indeed, vocabulary in Williams syndrome is consistently very delayed for several years, even though their language picks up later. And because we know that you need a certain level of vocabulary, a certain mass, some 200 words, that is going to impact on the beginnings of grammar, of combining words. So you get a long downstream effect over developmental time. Finally, something about autism. I'm sure you've been thinking, when on earth is she going to say something about the topic of this conference? As I said, I'm not an expert on autism, so I do this with some humility. But what I've done is tried to pull out some of the differences and similarities between autism spectrum disorders and Williams syndrome. Well, first, many people have presented this as looking as if they're opposite ends of a continuum. In autism spectrum disorders, genetically, most people have tended to think, though that is changing, I believe, that there are multiple genes of small effect. In Williams syndrome, by contrast, you have genetically 28 genes deleted, four of which we now know are of large effect. If we look phenotypically, people with autism tend to be aloof. They dislike looking at eyes and faces. By contrast, people with Williams syndrome are extremely friendly, overly friendly, inappropriately friendly, and are fascinated by eyes and faces. People with autism spectrum disorders prefer to interact with objects if given the choice. People with Williams syndrome definitely prefer to interact with people. People with ASD are good at spatial tasks if they are high-functioning. People with Williams syndrome, even when they're very high-functioning linguistically, are very poor at spatial tasks. So it looks as if they have nothing in common at all. But what I want to argue is that they actually do when you look for it. So first at the genetic and neural levels, a very quick word about genetics, but I've been reading recently about some new work which might suggest that there are similar challenges. Obviously not the same genes are involved at all. But if it's true that there are more de novo mutations in ASD compared to the normal population, then genes of large effect are going to be part of the problem that we have with Williams syndrome. But don't imagine for a moment, and I'm sure none of you do, that when you know which genes are involved, the mapping to behavior is easy. It's very complex because, again, it's extremely indirect. What about the brain? Well, it's quite clear that the overall pattern of brain atypicality is unique for each syndrome. But there are many structural and functional similarities which I believe are worth exploring. Very often when we compare the atypical brain to a normal brain, the differences are quite large. If we compare atypical brains across one another, the differences are more subtle, and I think they would help us make some headway in understanding. So we have definitely in both syndromes atypical cortical maturation. Gray matter and white matter integrity is compromised in both syndromes. There's dorsal stream vulnerability and ventral stream vulnerability in both syndromes. There are corpus callosum abnormalities in both syndromes. There's atypical functional connectivity, and this is particularly in the fusiform gyrus, amygdala, and orbital frontal cortex in both syndromes, of great interest because of the role of the amygdala. and unusual N400 in ERP studies in both syndromes. So the temporal dynamics look different in both syndromes. Now, I'm not saying that the differences are the same, but I think that if we start to compare at this level, we may come up with more subtle mappings to the cognitive outcome than if we compare just with the normal brain. What about cognitive associations? So first in childhood and adolescence and even adulthood. Well, both syndromes show a lot of similarities. There's a reduced inversion effect in face processing. So when you turn faces upside down, for normal people this is much harder. For people with autism or Williams syndrome, they show no difference because they're doing the job featurally. They have both of them have deficits identifying complex emotional expressions. Both have poor eye gaze direction understanding, but they're both fine with arrow gaze direction. We compared Williams and autism on this task. They both have serious delays in theory of mind tasks, although some of them eventually are able to do it if their verbal abilities are high enough. They both have problems with the pragmatics of language, even though their language abilities are different. They both are reported to have perfect pitch, so something about the auditory system has overlaps. They both lack auditory visual integration if you look at the McGurk effect. They both focus on local features at the expense of global configuration. And here we did do a comparison of Williams and ASD. This was work by Sarah Grice and other colleagues. And what we looked at was gamma band oscillations. We did this because in the gamma band, it's thought that this is a sign of integration of features. So we wanted to see whether the two syndromes had similar problems with integration or different ones. And if you look here, you can see that in the controls, you get these nice regular gamma band bursts every time a face is shown on the screen. And this pattern is somewhat different when the face is inverted. In autism, you do see the gamma band bursts, but they are not as neatly tied to the stimulus onset, and there's no difference between upright and inverted faces. By contrast, in Williams syndrome, the gamma band was almost flat. There were almost no bursts of activity, and this looks very much like two-month-old babies and not like adolescents at all. So the cross-syndrome comparison forced us into thinking differently about the notion of featural at the cognitive level, since at the brain level there's clearly a very big difference. And here we did some work in collaboration with real experts on autism, Francesca Happe and Rhonda Booth, and some undergraduate students of mine. And we looked at local featural global configural processing across modalities, so we looked at the visual spatial processing and auditory processing across 8 different tasks. And I obviously can't go in the time available to me into any detail here, but suffice it to say that when studied separately, the autism were much more featural than controls, and the Williams are much more featural than controls. But when you compare them directly, you start to see more subtle differences. Both can do some featural and some global processing. That was clear. But it was different where they could. In the Williams, they were far better at global processing in the auditory domain. They were able to take context into account. They were less able in the visual domain. We're also currently doing this with Down syndrome. But what we found really was that in Williams syndrome, the featural bias is due to a weakness in global processing, whereas in autism, the featural bias is due to a relative strength in featural processing. And this is not the same thing. And this is pushing us to look in more detail at the two syndromes and at these different tasks. What about much younger in babies and toddlers with the two syndromes? Well, again, we can find a lot of associations. There are difficulties in both syndromes with rapid eye movement planning, really atypical eye gaze following, atypical pointing, atypical triadic interaction in both, atypical implicit theory of mind, where you don't ask for judgment, but you just look at eye movements and where somebody anticipates that someone else will look. They have atypical face processing. They both have heightened reaction to sound. They both show obsessions, and they both have atypical sleep patterns. This is something we're looking at in some detail at the moment, looking at the role of sleep in the consolidation of learning. And again, they're atypical in both of the syndromes, although in slightly different ways. And they both have problems with attentional disengagement. So I want to suggest that there are a number of questions that we should be pursuing with this cross-syndrome approach. I believe that looking for associations rather than dissociations only, of course there are dissociations, I'm not denying that, can reveal more subtle details than the more gross comparison. The kinds of questions I believe we need to ask are, which other syndromes present with similar traits in infancy? And with my students, with Gaia Sherif and others, we've been comparing, alas, not autism this time, but Williams and Fragile X syndrome, Williams and 22q syndrome, again trying to pull out differences where often the same scores obtain, but we find different error patterns, and that allows us to look backwards into time and see where these different error patterns come from. We must ask which traits or sets of traits are syndrome specific and which seem to be more syndrome general, maybe due to mental retardation and so forth. And also, for which domains might a given trait be domain relevant across different domains? We tend to focus very much on a single domain, and it's this cross-syndrome domain approach that I am advocating. And we need to follow the trajectories over developmental time. I think that is crucially important. We can't just take snapshots. This is particularly the case if we look at genotype-phenotype relations, which we've been doing, where if you look at one age, you can say certain genes seem to play no role. And then if you look 2 or 3 years later, you have to conclude that those genes are playing a significant role because gene expression changes over time. We also have been looking at task-specific trajectories, so building in the normal, typical case, a trajectory for a task and then trying to plot our different syndromes on that trajectory to see whether it deviates, whether it's slower, and so forth, not just doing MA and CA matching. So I think there are two kinds of questions that we can ask as psychologists working in the neuroscience field. There are static questions, and some of these are actually quotes from people's papers. Which modules are impaired and which are intact? Where are they located in the brain? How are the syndromes dissociated? Which genes or set of genes map to the domain of deficit? I'm advocating a different approach, a more dynamic approach, where the first question we must always ask is there a developmental explanation? How do neurocircuits change over time? Do they become more restricted or not? How are syndromes dissociated, but also how are they associated? And do the mutated genes that we're looking at contribute to proficient domains and not only just to the impaired domains, the obviously impaired domains? I think this approach, this domain-relevant, what we've called neuroconstructivist approach, excuse me, causes the researcher to ask different kinds of questions, to predict less obvious deficits elsewhere in the system. Because once you look for a domain-relevant route to something, you can start to hypothesize that although people are scoring in the normal range, there may be different strategies involved, different tiny impairments that you can predict from this approach. It makes you investigate cross-domain interactions over time. How do domains interact? How does attention play a role across different domains and so forth? I believe it makes one think more dynamically and developmentally, but it's much harder. It's so much easier to do the sort of easy mapping, but this is what I think is absolutely crucial. And it makes one seek these much more indirect genotype-phenotype mappings. So let me conclude with something that we all know and we must always keep in mind, in my view, and I tend to also forget it, that nothing in biology or psychology is static. There are dynamic changes together with multidirectional interactions, not just brain to behavior, but interactions both ways, not just genes to outcome, but behavior that affects the expression of genes and so forth. So dynamic interactions over developmental time in gene expression, in brain structure, brain function, brain biochemistry, in cognitive processes, in overt behavior, and in the environment. And I don't think we pay enough attention really to the environment. There are many subtle differences that occur immediately a family is told your child has a neurodevelopmental disorder. There's a holding back of the way the child is allowed to explore the environment because one is more scared of accidents, etc. There's a holding back of making typical errors and overgeneralization because there's an understandable fear that the child may not learn. But if you overgeneralize, you then can form categories. And so there's a change, very subtle changes in the environment. And I don't know, but there may be subtle changes according to which developmental, neurodevelopmental disorder the child has and that the parents perceive as having different outcomes. So we need to also understand the dynamics of the environment as well as all these other dynamics. And with that, I shall close saying developmental time matters at every level of analysis. So if you forget everything I've said today, please remember that sentence. I'd like to thank all the people who've collaborated in this work, collaborators, postdocs, and students whom I've mentioned here, and to thank my funding agencies. Thank you.
So we have some time for some questions. Again, the microphones in front are on. I'll again break the ice by starting with maybe an incoherent question.
To which I'll give an incoherent answer.
And that is, you know, I wonder when you talk, can, maybe, you know, maybe I'll speak incoherent.
Hello?
Is this on? Okay. When one talks, you know, I wonder, you know, when you talk about, you know, the general versus specific, if one thing that could be going on is that disorders in general, neurodevelopmental disorders, increase variance in cognition in all the domains and or in trajectory. I mean, the trajectory is pretty clear, but I'm wondering about that. If one kind of component of having a neurodevelopmental disorder like autism is just increased variance, and therefore we see these talents, we see deficits in somebody. And I'm wondering if any of your data speaks to that issue or if that's not relevant.
We haven't really targeted that. I think it's an extremely important point. What we do see is huge variance compared to our typical controls. Whether the variance is greater in one syndrome or another, I don't know. I haven't looked at it. But I think that understanding individual differences, even in the typical population, is going to be very important in future. We've kind of ignored that in making our group summaries. But certainly in the atypical case, we see greater variance than we do in the normal case, but we've not really targeted that. I think it should be a target of research, actually. It's a very interesting idea.
Because, you know, I was thinking about this, even in our animal models, you know, we have a mouse behavior, we average the 10 or 15 with the mutation and the 10 or 15 normal, but, you know, what one, you know, and I've just noticed that we, you know, when you have a mutation or you have some developmental syndrome in an animal or human, one thing you're doing is actually increasing variance.
Yes.
It might be important to look
yes.
at.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I did say at one point that a lot of these differences are relative and not absolute, and that from looking at individual data and not just group data. But I think you're absolutely right. That's where our focus should go now.
Thanks.
I just want to say that it's a really important theoretical idea, the domain relevance idea. And my question has to do with empirically, how would you go about distinguishing between domain specificity and domain relevance? Take the example of face processing. Would you recommend, let's say, comparing children? You can look at face processing at a different age. So taking into consideration of development and also differences between groups. You might be predicting, for instance, Williams syndrome children would not differ as much from typically developing children, whereas once they're adults, the difference becomes larger. So can you say a little more about research-wise, how would you go about empirically testing the two different lines of work, other than the examples you gave, which is eye gaze patterns and so on? Those are all It's much harder to then track. It's easier for you to say, I've observed deficits in face processing. It's much harder to say, I think it's due to differences in eye gaze. Because then you have 100 different variables that you could look at.
It's true. It's not as easy by any means, but I'm advocating that we should do that. It's much easier to focus on a domain of deficit and probe that and look at its changes over time. But I don't think we'll ever be doing the right kinds of intervention if we only do that. So, yes, it's much harder. We've come up with different methods to look at that. So eye tracking is one, and it's not just in face processing. You can use it in language, for instance. So as you're speaking, we're anticipating all the time what the next words will be, and our eye movements will often give clues to that. So you can look at that in atypically developing children, something I've been talking about with Jeff Ellman when I came yesterday. So I think there are other domains in which you can ask these questions. It requires also, I think, a period of really rich observation of babies with atypical development and also a knowledge of typical development to see what kind of things go wrong. Attention is one that you would look at, obviously, and we've done a lot of work now using attention as one of the means to say, if you have poor sustained attention, what could the outcome be? If you have rapid shifts of attention and can't keep your attention on something and always turn to any peripheral stimulus, what would the outcome be? How would that affect different domains? It's an exercise that I think you have to do. I don't think it's entirely unconstrained, though.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask, as people leave, can you please close the door behind you, just because the noise from the back is filtering in? Thank you.
I can understand the emphasis on the domains and the relevance on that when you're talking about a specific genetic mutation. Is it as relevant, let's say, if there is an environmental or a stress-related or a toxin that could affect, let's say, the developing baby in the uterus at various times or in early childhood, where the domain then might be when this event occurred rather than targeting a specific domain genetically? Is that...
I'm not sure I understand, but I wouldn't think that...
I mean, if there was a stress-related...
No, I understand what you're asking. So rather than having the cause be genetic, have the cause be environmental.
Which
but that's
vary,
still... Yeah, but
which
that...
Which would vary at the time of occurrence.
Okay,
so
but that would...
First trimester, second...
Yeah, but I don't see how that... negates the need to look for low-level processes that impact on a developing system, because if you have something, whether it occurs in the first, second, or third trimester, you still have to understand the impact of that on the developing system subsequently. You're going to look for different causes, but I don't see that makes such a difference.
So
maybe I'm misunderstanding you.
Okay, so the domain would be related to a specific time point rather than a specific genetic deficit.
It could be, yes. One would always have to ask that question. Sure, I understood.
You mentioned sleep abnormalities that could potentially be associated with learning impairments. And that's a very interesting thought because it's been shown that there are synchronous fluctuations in brain activity during sleep that potentially could be important for the formation of functional networks in development.
Yes.
I was wondering, is that a thought you just put out there because it's, a speculative thought, or is there actually, for Williams syndrome, is there actually direct evidence?
We now have evidence. We've been comparing Williams and Downs for the moment, but I read some literature on autism showing different sleep disturbances in terms of onset of sleep latency, night waking, and so forth. But also, we're looking at resting state brain activity, and that differs across these different syndromes. It hasn't yet been tied into the different sleep phases, and that's the next thing that we need to do. And we're also interested in the consolidation of learning, because there's a lot of literature showing that sleep consolidates learning. And we'd like to know whether this is a contributor, an impairment in this would be a contributor to outcome, and differently so depending on the different syndromes. It's work in progress at the moment. I mentioned it because I think it's another thing that tends to be forgotten when we focus just on a domain. If we start to think on what are all the influences that may conjure to give rise to a developmental outcome, then sleep patterns are one of them.
Thanks. So I really enjoyed your presentation, and I thought the final slide, at least the penultimate slide, which talked about the focus on a developmental process was really critical, especially because generally for brain disorders, cognition and behavior are the last thing to change. And we know that from especially neurodegenerative disorders where the brain's changing for 20 or 30 years before the first signs. Here's the problem we have, which is that for either Down's or autism, or even for Fragile X, we make a diagnosis once we think there's something wrong, and we think there's something wrong because of a change in behavior or cognition, at which point all of the things that you're interested in have been happening for a long time already. So help us think about how do we move upstream from that?
That's a really good question and a difficult one. I think my feeling is that the earlier we understand both the changes in the brain, the changes in these very sort of low-level processes that occur, the better. So I would want to shift a lot of the research emphasis to really, really early development. And getting our intervention in before things start to develop. So I, when I say early, I mean if necessary in fetal life as well. I could imagine lots of interventions that could be done during the latter part of fetal life, because there's been a lot of work now showing how the, at least the typically developing fetus, is processing a lot of auditory input, for instance. So I just go earlier and earlier to have an impact on the system.